The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop.
Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 15 of War Notes, a conflict podcast. The title of this one is called Freeboot Reboot 21st Century PMC and War. PMC would be private military corporations. So before we get started with the episode, I'd like to do a little bit of housekeeping, as is my wont. Last month, episode 9, Fixing Fight Club, Just Say No to NATO, in my War Notes series, Fixing Fight Club, I had made the case, I thought, rather strongly why the U.S. needs to get out of NATO. Well, things haven't gotten any better since that time that I published it, just a little over a month ago. And now what I find so shocking about the EU and our European allies, I put that in air quotes, that we find member nations, individuals, or even collectively, where they're complaining not only about the noises that the current administration is making about a possible exit from NATO, but also going to extremes such as Canada threatening the United States with trying to co-opt nuclear weapons to protect itself from U.S. aggression, Canada being a NATO nation itself, and all the rest of the noise and rhetorical flourishes bandied about by the members of the EU in their NATO costumes, talking about the abandonment by the United States and making threats which basically mean that if you're not willing to invoke Article 5 on a nation, in this case the nation is Ukraine, that is not a member of NATO, and this has been floated by some of the lunatics in the EU, then you are a clear and present danger to NATO. Basically, what we're in with NATO, as far as I'm concerned, is an abusive relationship in which the spouse is constantly mauling the breadwinner in this case being the United States. I cannot emphasize strongly enough that peace, even at some cost, is usually the correct answer more so than war. And what we find is that the EU halls in Brussels and NATO itself all across the continent are just consumed by such a hatred and vitriol against Russia in this case. The saber rattling gets more and more boisterous by these same folks who just so happen to have led us into two world wars in the 20th century. Of course, we all know that all those world wars were eminently preventable, and that those of us who are amateur historians like myself and have read deeply of conflict and 20th century conflict in particular know that it was the alliance and the treaties from the turn of the 20th century until August, September of 1914 that led to not only the call for war, the march for war, but war actual happening as a result of these entangling alliances. And of course, George Washington warned us in the 18th century what those kind of entangling alliances could do, and I would add what those entangling alliances can do absent context. So I repeat what I said in episode 9, Just Say No to NATO. We need to get out soonest. My plea to the current administration is that you start the time phase redeployment planning process in order to get all dependents, all soldiers, all U.S. military personnel and their support personnel out of Europe in the next 30 days so that we don't act as a human tripwire to be embroiled in yet another conflict on that continent as a result of poor judgment, bad manners, and lack of preparation. If my protestations against NATO, make you uncomfortable or you find it rather disagreeable, you have two options. You can hang out with me because, after all, I do have Dutch blood and Afrikaans blood, which makes me naturally disagreeable. Or you can go elsewhere to hear whatever megaphone blasts philosophically and morally fill the black hole in your soul, which calls for war at all cost. I always find it so amusing where folks who think that persons with my interest in particularly arcane and esoteric expertise in irregular warfare and conflict futurism and that type of thing, they must be so interested in war that they are warmongers. I happen to be extraordinarily anti-war. There is a reason why I wear the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute, which is connected to antiwar.com, which is an advocacy organization that tries to avoid war at all costs. Now, this doesn't mean that one lays down in a fashion in which you are prostrate or supine and unarmed, and you are subject to the wiles and wills of whatever barbarians or civilizational cosplayers may be out there who wish to start a new war locally, across a continent, or maybe globally. So what you will always find as an undercurrent, a shadow context, is that war is a terrible thing. I may be expert at it from an historical perspective. I am both a former practitioner and now a scholar when it comes to this, but much like becoming a doctor, being a doctor doesn't make you a champion for disease. It makes you someone who has invested all the time and years in the inquiry possible in order either to stem the tide of disease or find ways to get around it or alleviate it. One observation and then some admin notes. I was recently north of where I am now, and we were visiting Gainesville, Florida, where the Gators and the University of South Florida is, with a huge campus complex. And I find myself so depressed nowadays going around to those campus complexes and maybe dining out or being able to rub shoulders with students, faculty, administrators alike. And the absolute uniform waste of human resources, time, intellectual inquiry, and moral examination that takes place on these huge academic enclaves. Not only do I see enormous academic fraud, scientific fraud, lack of footnoting, I think that plagiarism, like what was discovered with the president of Harvard who lost her job in the last few years, is that plagiarism that you saw there is the tip of the iceberg. I would suggest that if it were possible for a deep-pocketed philanthropist, I'm looking at you, Elon Musk, to fund a team, much like Doge, that would use the AI resources that they have to electronically evaluate all published academic journals, starting with non-STEM, then moving to STEM. And what they would be trying to do is establish the provenance of data. They would establish if the footnotes that were cited were connected to the work and were taken in the context in presentation in the work that showed them to have the veracity, validation, accuracy, and precision of what their prognostications are in that publication, and that they need to find out just how big is the fraud, because the multi-billion dollar a year could be approaching trillions if you aggregated it over time, of money that comes from the government and is siphoned to the university establishments across the country. There are so many problems. I should devote an entire episode to all of my misgivings about government subsidy and funding of K through PhD, because I do think that it may be the root cause and the fulcrum upon which so many of our civilizational ills are based. But there needs to be a wholesale electronic examination. I say electronic examination because it would be the easiest way to do it instead of looking at written, hardbound publications, which would take years, decades, possibly centuries to go through. But now, Doge, the Department of Government Efficiency, has shown us that they have these magical tools that they can employ. And if only they would focus those on all of these academic journals so that Americans and those abroad can see not only that the scientific consensus in so many areas is errant and wrong, but they would discover that it's a fix, it's a scam, it's a huge government fraud money complex that feeds all of this. And another thing that I would ask for is, how many citations from said academic journals and journal articles are out there and used in a way that expands our understanding of the world? That fraud is so great that there is a reproducibility crisis planet-wide, especially in the English-speaking West, when it comes to scientific and engineering applications. Now, as an engineer myself, we happen to be in the scientific profession in which all of our errors, failures, and mistakes are made manifest, sometimes costing human lives, sometimes costing very costly mistakes in building and such, but it's all out there. Now, abstract science, and better yet, pure science and those kind of endeavors are even more hidden from that OODA loop that we engineers suffer from, where we are subject to public scrutiny at all times with the things that we produce. Just check out Amazon reviews of objects people purchase that have been engineered, fabricated, manufactured, and then sold at the retail and wholesale level, and you'll see what I'm talking about. So, anyhow, I got that off of my chest, and I just wanted to vent a little bit. So now we are going to continue with this episode. Again, episode 15, Freeboot Reboot, 21st Century PMC and War. So what we're discussing today is we're talking about what many people would charitably call mercenaries. We're talking about people who fight wars in a private fashion for private pay. Although one will find in this very obtuse, obscure, and increasingly large world of mercenary soldiers, it's not as easy as one would divine that it is, where we have all of these storied fables from Africa in the later part of the 20th century. Many have seen depictions in the media, for instance, like if you watch The Wild Geese, which is a lot of fun, but narratively speaking, it's mostly fiction dressed as sort of nonfiction. One can look at what happened in Biafra and countless places across Africa where mercenaries were employed to either good ends or bad ends. You're going to see me on here quoting from Dr. Sean McFate. You will see his references in the footnotes. I find him to be a very able observer of the mercenary phenomenon in the 21st century. You will also find me recommending that you read Venter's book, War Dogs, if you're interested to find out the history in the 20th and 21st century. And don't confuse yourself by thinking that mercenaries are a new phenomenon. They've been around ever since warfare landed in the human psyche millennia ago. So going back to Mr. McFate, who gives a great example, or is it Dr. McFate? Could be Dr. McFate. I'm quoting from Mercenaries and War, Understanding Private Armies Today, Sean McFate. He writes, quote, "As for the previous 4,000 years, mercenaries were a feature, often the main feature of war. The word mercenary comes from the Latin mercis, wages or pay, and is no different than the solda, or pay due to fighters, from which the word soldier is derived. For much of the past, mercenaries and soldiers are synonymous. Most of military history is privatized, and mercenaries are as old as war itself. The reason is simple. Renting force is cheaper than owning it. Maintaining a permanent military seems normal today, but it is not. Paying for one's own armed forces is ruinously expensive, similar to owning a private jet versus buying a plane ticket when you need it. Why invest in your own expensive standing army when you could just rent one?" He goes on, "Mercenaries are everywhere in military history, starting with the Bible. The Old Testament mentions hired warriors several times and never with reproach. Everyone used them. There was King Shulgi of Ur's army from 2029 to 1982 BCE. Xenophon had a huge army of Greek mercenaries known as the 10,000. That, of course, lives long in history and the landmark Xenophon's Anabasis, edited by Shane Brennan and David Thomas. It's a new translation by David Thomas, is the one that I would recommend if you want to read that ripping good yarn on those 10,000 mercs who found their way back to their homeland through many very interesting challenges. McFate goes on, the Middle Ages were a mercenary heyday. Nearly half of William the Conqueror's army in the 11th century was made up of hired swords, as he could not afford a large standing army, and there was not enough nobles and knights to accomplish the Norman conquest of England. King Henry II of England engaged mercenaries to suppress the Great Rebellion of 1171 to 1174. And this goes on and on, so I'm not going to burden you with going over these again and again, because you can read these for yourself. You will find McFate's pamphlet, as it were, in the footnotes for you to read at your leisure. Now, mind you, in my research for this particular episode, I found that the most widely accepted definition of a mercenary in international law comes from Article 47 of Protocol 1 to the Geneva Convention, which states, quote, a mercenary shall not have the right to be a combatant or a prisoner of war. Two, a mercenary is any person who is especially recruited locally or abroad in order to fight in an armed conflict. B, does in fact take a direct part in the hostilities. C, is motivated to take part in the hostilities essentially by the desire for private gain, and in fact is promised by or on behalf of a party to the conflict material compensation. But, and here's the big but, this is absolutely unusable. The characterization of a mercenary is so restrictive yet imprecise that anyone can wiggle out of it. And quoting Jeffrey Best, the military historian, quote, any mercenary who cannot exclude himself from this definition deserves to be shot and his lawyer with him, end of quote. The bottom line is mercenaries are here to stay, and state conflict actors and national actors paid by governments and the state. Look, in order to examine this more effectively, I need to establish a bifurcation rhetorically between combat service support, combat support, and actual trigger pullers and combatants who engage in warfare proper at the bleeding edge. In other words, for the longest time, I spent almost 2 years in Afghanistan. One could charitably call me a mercenary because I was there as a contractor. And that what you found over there was you found folks who were involved in all the logistical problem sets for war, who tended not to be members of militaries, but were folks who saw lucrative contracts and pay available to them to go into a regional conflict zone, in this case, Iraq, Afghanistan. It may have even happened in Libya, the Horn of Africa, Syria, Yemen, places like that. Although I think the availability of Western contractors to go into the ones that I just mentioned are probably very problematic, and that's a good way to separate pieces of your body from where they belong as a result of being in those regions because of the absolutely insane hatred against Westerners, period. By the way, most of that hatred certainly is fueled by invasion, but to a lesser extent, but significant extent, of Western treatment of all of these countries, especially in the Middle East, especially in Africa, over time, and how awful it has been for their nation states. So in my treatment for this brief period of time for this particular episode, I want to concentrate on the trigger pullers, the combatants, the folks who actually go over there, not as nation state soldiers, but as privately hired soldiers to execute combat missions. Now, you have to remember the shadowy and rather ambiguous legal frameworks that mercenaries, as I have characterized, thanks to Sean McFate, much more specifically than I could have done otherwise, is that you have the Hague Convention. I mentioned the Geneva Convention earlier. These tend to be the international rules of land warfare and even ocean warfare by extension, even though piracy, letters of marque, and those kind of provisions make for some very interesting special cases when it comes to the high seas. I don't know whether that will be within the scope of this particular episode. Maybe we will examine that sometime in the future, because there is a long history in not only United States history with letters of marque, which is essentially where the government, in this case the United States, went to private contractors who had ships and asked them to practice a form of piracy that had the legal imprimatur of the U.S. government at the time. Nothing's new about what happened in the late 18th century with the U.S. government issuing letters of marque. Letters of marque being a French word that means a government license in the age of sail that authorized a private person known as a privateer or a corsair to attack and capture vessels of a foreign state at war with the issuer, licensing international military operations against a specified enemy as reprisal for a previous attack or injury. It's a French word, marque, lettre de marque. As I mentioned, there's nothing new here because the first recorded use of letters of marque and reprisal was in an English statute in 1354 during the reign of King Edward III. The phrase referred to a license granted by a sovereign to a subject, authorizing him to make reprisals on the subjects of hostile state for injuries alleged to have been done to him by the enemy's army. And what piqued my interest to do this episode in the first place was that with the new administration taking office and the whirlwind that it has been in policy reversals and adoption of new and emerging technologies and ways of doing business in the 21st century, and at last recognizing that there are revolutions in military affairs, that there have been whisperings and trial balloons floated about issuing letters of marque, issuing the private means and the protection thereof from the government for folks to work on bounties, for folks to work as individuals or groups to achieve certain military objectives and doing it for remuneration from the government. There is a rich and deep history of military law when it comes to the international laws of land warfare, as I mentioned before, because in essence what the international laws of land warfare does is it takes militaries that kill people and break things for a living and tries to make a demarcation, a barrier, as it were, between their behavior and that of wholesale-level serial killers. For instance, you will find that when prisoners are, potential prisoners in this case, are surrendering, you are to accept their surrender and not shoot them dead. You are to not bomb hospitals or marked places, whether holy, religious, or whatever the case may be. There are certain groups within society that can't be targeted. Those who are non-combatants tend to find protections from these hordes of military folks. You will also find in history as recently as the 20th century some aberrations in this, and you would find that with the Japanese, for instance. Ironically enough, after the 1905 Russo-Japanese War, in which the Japanese, after a mere two generations of mature military entry into the world as a fighting force exporting from Japan proper, because Japan before that time had never been successfully invaded and would not be successfully invaded until the Second World War. I read accounts where during World War I, when the Japanese were the allies of the West fighting the Germans at the time, the Japanese were lauded not only for their behavior during 1905 in the Russo-Japanese War with their explicit and kind treatment of all surrendered prisoners in the most cordial way possible, the same thing extended in World War I, but then we have, after a generation passes from the cessation of hostilities in November 1918 until the beginning of new hostilities by Japanese against China beginning 1932 to 1938, that within that brief, relatively brief span of time, they do a complete 180 on their treatment of prisoners, and things become very awful for those who are captured by the Japanese forces post-World War I. I give you this as an example of what animated some of the international laws of land warfare, especially after World War II, and the Japanese were patient zero for a lot of the modifications that were meant to instantiate more civil ways to conduct conflict. So recently, Eric Prince of Blackwater fame, or infame, however you'd like to characterize it yourself, was at his alma mater, which is Hillsdale College, with Grove City College, is one of only two colleges in the entire United States that accepts no federal funding whatsoever. The title of that, and I put it in the show notes, was A Future of Dynamic Warfare. And I highly recommend it because, love him or hate him, I love the innovation and the direct addressing of revolutions and military affairs that Eric Prince characterizes in this great interview. So please, I urge you to take a listen. I think it's an hour and 15 minutes worth your time. Not too long to read if you're interested in this sort of thing. But I also think that while Blackwater does have its misses, it certainly has its hits, and it's probably the most famous poster boy, bully boy, or pinata for a lot of folks to show why mercenary corporations and private military corporations are not the wave of the future, but should be crushed at every opportunity. I don't happen to agree with that. It didn't start with Blackwater, and as I demonstrated to you earlier, this goes back thousands of years in conflict, but if we look at the country of Africa, for instance, during the entirety of the 20th century, especially after World War II, you've seen time after time where these particular entities are used to shift the dynamics to change the face of governments or conflict. There was an enterprising fellow by the name of Eben Barlow towards the end of the 20th century who had an organization called Executive Outcomes that took part in rather successful military operations as a privately contracted organization to solve problems on the Dark Continent. So if you get the opportunity to listen to that, I highly recommend it. I think that you'll find it very illuminating. I want to talk a bit about market globalization when it comes to mercenaries. And again, I'm drawing from McFate's article, which is fascinating. Quote, heavy U.S. reliance on military contractors has catalyzed the international mercenary trade, with supply and demand diversifying, expanding, and chilling ways on the supply side. The United States has marshaled a global labor pool of mercenaries. Thousands of mercenaries got their start in Iraq or Afghanistan, and when those wars shrank, they set out looking for new conflict markets, that is, war zones, around the world, enlarging the wars there. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan allowed the private military industry to mature with networks of mercenaries established and some modicum of best practices. Others are imitating the American model, and every day new military groups emerge from countries like Russia, Uganda, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Colombia. Their services are more robust than Blackwater, offer greater combat power and the willingness to work for the highest bidder with scant regard for human rights. They are mercenary in every sense of the word, end of quote. He goes on with an interesting observation where he says, quote, on the demand side, the United States has a de facto legitimized mercenaries by using them so heavily. Can the United States really tell Russia, with the Wagner Group, for instance, not to use private military troops in Syria? No, it cannot. New consumers are appearing everywhere, seeking security in an insecure world. Oil and mining companies guarding their drill sites against militias, shipping lines defending their vessels against pirates, humanitarian organizations protecting their workers in dangerous locations, oligarchs who need professional muscle, countries that want to wage proxy wars, regimes fighting civil wars, guerrillas fighting back, and the super rich for any reason you can think of, no matter how petty, end of quote. So in my youth, I really enjoyed military science fiction, and I grew up on some of the work of one of my favorite authors, who happens to be Jerry Purnell. And Jerry Purnell, along with some others, wrote books about these mass military mercenary organizations. His would be Falkenberg's Legionaries. There's the Hammer Slammers by David Drake, which was also characterizing these kind of mass mercenary militaries. And in this case, they had all kinds of things to include everything from orbital dropships to tanks, and then they would contract out for their services, go and conduct said services, and then get a handsome return on their investment. I have always thought, and I think the Atlantic Council has leveraged this, that the use of speculative fiction and science fiction to extrapolate what future conflict looks like is a really useful exercise for designing and architecting present forces to be able to fight in the future. So that has been a motif, especially of War Notes, and I've tackled that on occasion in the Chasing Ghosts podcast. But I also want to bring up something else. In episode 13, I talked about infantry folding its colors and the fact that with the new RMAs that we have presently, that the infantry itself, whether as individual soldiers or in fire teams, squads, platoons, companies, or even larger formations, may be very well going the way of the dodo. I could be wrong. We shall see what happens. That's why I like to forecast and not predict, because there's less of an evidentiary bar for me when I'm speculating and forecasting on what the future fight looks like. In this case, the mercenary may not be what you see on the cover of either popular magazines or what you've seen portrayed in the media as far as Iraq and Afghanistan and the trigger puller mercenaries such as Blackwater, Triple Canopy, and all the rest of them being these big roided up fellas in camouflage uniforms with the latest tech, the latest gear, and just armed to the teeth. It may be very different in what those mercenary permutations look like for the remainder of the 21st century when it comes to conflict. Because remember, one of the things that I've always emphasized is that when it comes to individuated single combat and the fight with riflemen and such, that is in the hazard as we speak, despite the 4,000-year provenance of the infantryman as a main feature on world battlefields, east and west. That may be coming to an end. I have also told many of my listeners, and some of whom were just as disappointed as I was, that the idea of having these exoskeletons, these power suits where you take the variations as we've seen demonstrated in the gameplay of Halo and other science fiction venues, that all of a sudden we have human beings, these biological sacks of life shoved into these exoskeletons to become super soldiers. And then you have to ask yourself, especially with the advent of AI, with the advent of the internet, with the advent of electronic sophistication, and the ability to have first-person UAVs and such, that why put a human being in those when those can simply be robotic soldiers? I do think, maybe I'll be wrong in the future, we shall say, I do think that the future is going to be ground-bound robotics when it comes to infantry fights. I think that not only ground-bound robotics with those Boston Dynamics quadruped robot dogs that you've seen, maybe even more bipedal features when it comes to these kind of robotic entities that will take the place of infantry fighters on the field. And of course, we know as a result of how economies of scale works that it will probably become cheaper over time to deploy these modalities on the battlefield. So the point that I'm trying to get at, excuse the excursion, was that the mercenary fights for the remainder of this century are not going to look like the mercenary fights that are characterized so and popularized in the media as that motley crew of uniform fellas that I talked to you about who go into a country and do the deed that normal armed forces do, except they're doing it for filthy lucre. I think in this case, a lot of those mercenaries are going to be maybe former members of the United States Drone Racing League, all 35,000 of those folks, who find that they're offered remuneration and very generous paychecks for taking their drone racing skills and offering them up to a country that has weaponized drones and UASs. And they become, in a very mercenary sense, soldiers who are deployed comfortably in an air-conditioned space to conduct their military violence. What I'm saying is that there have been popular conceptions in the past, as I told you about a few minutes ago, that you can have your truck drivers, you can have your folks who are manning the warehouses, you can have your folks who are doing all the hard logistics works who aren't members of an armed force of a nation, but have been hired by the National Armed Forces that happen to be in that country conducting a military campaign as civilians who aren't federally employed civilians or even state employed civilians, but folks who are on a private contract from a private vendor who provides the folks they need to fill those non-combat billets in or near combat zones. So here's the new wrinkle for PMCs, private military corporations. That whole romantic or not so romantic portrayal of the fighters slogging against each other and hammering it out with rifles and direct fire, maybe indirect fires with mortars and things like that. Maybe the new mercenary permutations that we're going to see in the 21st century are going to be something like the permutations of artillery that I have illustrated in previous podcast episodes, where I told you that the Russians, when they characterized the use of UAS, UAVs, and robotics in warfare, have simply taken their center of gravity, which is artillery in their armed forces since the beginning of the 20th century, and they've made UASs, FPVs, and all of these combat modalities new 21st century artillery permutations. So what I'd like to get at here is that mercenaries are here to stay, but that the popular media conception of mercenaries engaged directly in combat and suffering by being wounded or killed in the process, that isn't necessarily going to be all the trigger pulling mercenaries. What I'd like to park in your brain pan is this notion, is that in the future, the number of mercenaries will not diminish, it will increase, and that those mercenaries will be engaging in activities for the first time in over 4,000 years of human conflict, in which they probably can't even physically see the targets they will be engaging, and that for the most part, as this century progresses, the very notions of human infantry combat, close combat, armored combat, all of those things are probably going to become smaller and smaller. They will shrink into insignificance, and it will become a war of salvo competition, as I've talked about before. It will become a war of leakers. It will become a war of lobbing missiles. It will become a war of using UASs, FPVs, and things like that, and that those people, whatever human beings are going to be in that milieu of conflict, they will be mercenaries, and there will be plenty of them, but they will be doing very curious things, whether from modified video game consoles or, as I mentioned earlier, the drone racing league champions, who will be quite literally manning in a virtual sense all of these weapons of war that will be used to slam the opponent. I want to address another thing, and that's this. There is also this notion that if they're mercenaries, they're merciless, they're brutal, they're awful, they do the worst things. I would urge everybody listening to this podcast not only to take a look at atrocities committed by national armed forces, but I'd also like you to take a very close look, if you will, at UN Blue Helmet missions around the world and especially in Africa. And look at what happens when these apparently nationally sponsored and hosted entities and the kind of corruption, privation, maiming, killing, and theft that those organizations engage in under the blue and white flag. I also want to remind everybody listening to my voice as we speak that I just published a two-part series on the Mexican cartels and the notions by the current administration in the United States of taking the war to the cartels. And I tried to describe and forecast why that may be a rather imprudent position to take and what's going to happen as a result of that. And what you have with the cartels, for instance, and I'm not saying that the United States or even other Western countries can't afford the best and the brightest when it comes to mercenary trigger pullers and such. But here you have a non-state entity. And by the way, when I say non-state entity, when I'm talking about the Mexican cartels, I may be fibbing a bit because I see no demarcation between the Mexican government and the cartels themselves. I think that they are intimately and very atomistically woven into each other as a core tapestry and fabric of the way that country's politics works. But in this case, the cartels are rich, and they can afford to have a very deep and broad bench of military talent stacks that they hire on to do the things that they do. And what makes them so powerful in this sense is they share with a number of Western intelligence agencies that happen to have paramilitary branches attached to them a no-holds-barred approach that has no rules of the road that necessarily have to be followed via the Hague and Geneva Conventions, and can not only take part in those kind of activities, but to hone those activities into an unconscious competence that makes them quite lethal and able to strike a blow in a fashion that is going to be disproportionate to the resources that they have. So I will illustrate it in this fashion. When it comes to special operations forces, and for instance, my experience in special forces, is that a lot of special operations forces, from an unconventional standpoint, are able to achieve what's called strategic compression, which is where you use tactical means to achieve strategic objectives, where you take small teams of very talented men, you send them into the fray, into the hazard, and they accomplish things that are disproportionate to their size and the expense of what they were designed to do in the first place. It just seems to me that when I try to grok this situation right now of what's going on in the 21st century warfare, that a lot of these things that I have talked about are starting to mingle with each other. For instance, the very idea that the sophisticated peer armed forces of the various nation states, the US, the West, those in the East, and other entities, despite their protestations out loud, cannot do without mercenary forces in both their distinctions. They cannot do without the mercenaries that provide for the logistical means for them to conduct war. Because remember, I think it was Tom Clancy, but I'm going to riff and a paraphrase off of it, where amateurs are concerned with tactics and professionals are concerned with logistics. And of course, war winners are concerned with energy. Now, what we have here is we have a time and place in human history where these armed forces, these peer forces, cannot not have these mercenary forces that provide for their logistical trains, logistical means, and manning, those kind of things, so that they can take whatever trigger pullers they may have and let them do what they do for a living. But they still have an insubstantial combat power capability that will be met in that vacuum with these mercenaries, these private military corporations. You'll note that PMCs, private military corporations, in all of their literature try to avoid mercenary because mercenary is a four-letter word in the public mind. The other advantage, of course, of private military corporations, and Eric Prince is probably one of the standouts when it comes to this, is that unlike the fossilized, arthritic, and sclerotic organizations that the Department of Defense in the United States has in the Pentagon, they tend to be folks, in this case, the PMCs, that have to make a profit. They have to be able to take all the elements of combat power that they employ and make them make sense from an effectiveness perspective, which is something that isn't done by the conventional hidebound statist organizations like the DOD at the Pentagon. For instance, when it comes to SpaceX, the extraordinary rocketry that has been proven, exploited, expanded, and made better every year by Elon Musk and SpaceX and some other private space entities In one respect, it's due to this very simple notion. NASA, which stands for Never Ascend to Space Again, ever since the Apollo program, has had an absolutely terrible problem with rocketry, reliable space transport, low Earth orbit entities going up there that are manned, that they work out and conduct really well. They don't do that. So here you have Elon Musk doing two extraordinary things. Number one, he retrieves the stages of rockets for reuse. He first does it on the ocean, he does it landbound, and then he does it with the extraordinary gantry setup that he has where the rocket stage returns and lands itself onto a gantry instead of a deck. And these reuse, these platforming, these composability ideas that Musk is doing with what is arguably one of the most difficult engineering prospects for humanity, rocketry that reaches low Earth orbit, and in this case, returns. Why would NASA not do that? NASA wouldn't do it because it wasn't within their engineering imagination, because being a statist complex and quite literally a government monopoly that doesn't have to reuse because it has an almost infinite access to other people's money, in this case, tax monies, or whether that comes from living human beings or our unborn children and grandchildren. But nonetheless, it simply isn't in their imagination to bother with that because they're not a private entity, which is why mercenary organizations and private military corporations, whether you like them or not, are going to press ahead facing these revolutions in military affairs for the entirety of the remainder of this 21st century, and things are going to get and be very interesting. I see no way in the evolution of warfare for the remainder of this century for private industry not to find better ways to do things. For instance, one thing that has stymied the engineering of exquisite platforms in the government sector, I would say arguably since the end of the Vietnam War, and plagued the United States with platform after platform that has been nothing more than palpable failure at every turn, that one of the reasons for that is because of the Last Supper that took place in 1993, a Pentagon dinner for the chiefs of the nation's biggest defense contractors, hosted by then Secretary of Defense Les Aspin and his deputy, William J. Perry, who later succeeded Aspin in the top job. Along with the meal, Aspin and Perry served a blunt notice. The level of defense spending, which was already on a five-year slide, was going to fall much farther and fast. Most of the guests were savvy to the situation. Defense buyouts, mergers, and sell-offs had been producing at pace since 1986. However, Aspin and Perry urged their dinner guests to take consolidation much further, much faster, and this reduced the number of defense companies, big defense companies, from 51 to 5. Fast forward to today, and you have those five uniformly producing exquisite platforms, and I've been asked by listeners what an exquisite platform is. It's everything from a multi-million-dollar tank to a multi-billion-dollar set of aircraft or ships. Very few of those programs have been successful. After the Arleigh Burke hole was laid down in 1991, it was the last successful surface warfare hole that the U.S. Navy would put into seawater for the remainder of that century and the entirety of this one. And what that means is that the Ford-class aircraft carrier cannot reliably retrieve and launch aircraft. The little crappy ship, the LCS, has been a signature multi-billion dollar failure. The Zumwalt, originally, we were going to have 10 of those new fabbed destroyers. I think that we have two presently. 29 potential ships canceled. Two more naval ship, surface warfare ship programs that the Navy is going to engage in as we speak. And of course, I have no doubt whatsoever that those will fail also. The F-35 Alpha Bravo Charlie, it speaks for itself what a very expensive failure that fifth generation fighter has been. And on, part of that is because of the defense consolidation resulted in the big players in the defense industry going to the government after the Last Supper in 1993 and assuming the best and insisting that the government, and the government was more than happy to do so, erect legal barriers to competition so that the kind of innovation that comes from small and hungry companies is virtually eliminated. What you will find, for instance, is that you can find many examples where smaller companies that were really innovative and forward-thinking purchased by bigger companies, and instead of the bigger companies that purchased them, allowing them to be single entities that could thrive rather autonomously, they were forced to assume the bigger corporate ecology behavior that led to them structurally and definitively zeroing out and retarding all possible innovations that would take place over time. Now, none of this is helped by the Sovietized and arthritic acquisition system known as JSIDS in the United States that has piled failure after failure in spending trillions of dollars to make the United States, as we speak today, the premier 20th century fighter in the world of the 21st century. So I want to read some further excerpts from Sean McFate, and I have his article posted in the show notes in case you'd like to read it. And I would urge you to read it. Quote, "The market for force cannot be regulated because mercenaries can kill law enforcement. International public law is feeble and difficult to enforce. One famed legal scholar called it the vanishing point of law since it is followed by courtesy rather than compellence. This is especially true with the law of armed conflict. There is no international judiciary, police force, or prisons, so there's little consequence for violating the law. Some believe accountability can be maintained if Washington places military contractors under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. However, this solves little. First, it does not apply to the bulk of mercenaries today who are not on a U.S. contract. Second, for those hired by Washington, the solution is impractical. Take, for example, the issue of jurisdiction. What happens if a Colombian private military contractor kills an Afghan family while on an American contract? Does he go to trial in Afghanistan, the United States, Colombia, or nowhere? No one really knows, and a good labor lawyer could probably shred the case in minutes." End of quote. I want you to know that this article was written in 2019, hence his contemporaneous use of Afghanistan. He avers further, quote, "Some suggest market mechanisms to shape industry behavior. Super buyers can use their market power to establish rules of the road by rewarding good force providers with lucrative contracts while driving out the rest out of business. Who is a super buyer? The United States was during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and the UN could be if it privatizes peacekeeping. However, the U.S. did not do this, and the UN probably will not either. Alternatively, a cartel of buyers could accomplish it, but cartels are tough to maintain because defections are cheap while holding fast is expensive. Or the world could achieve what states did after 1648, Treaty of Westphalia, and slowly monopolize the market. For this to work, all countries would have to pool their resources to abolish mercenarism in a unified front for decades to come. World peace might be easier." End of quote. There is an organization called the International Stability Operations Association, which is sort of like an international organization for mercenary and private force contract work, formerly known as the International Peace Operations Association, but they morphed into this. If you go to their website, there's a lot of really interesting information there. I haven't been able to grok all of it, but it does seem to be a stab at organizing and contractually obligating a better kind of behavior on the conflict scene and the battlefields when it comes to PMCs. The future will tell us just how successful that is. But McFate puts paid to this, quote, "Unfortunately, mercenaries are here to stay. Those who think the private military industry can be safely ignored, regulated, or categorically banned are too late. After 150 years underground, the market for force has returned in just two decades, and it is growing at an alarming rate. As the market expands, security will become a good investment and fuel the marketplace in a self-feeding loop. New consumers will seek security in an increasingly insecure world, and new mercenaries will pop up to meet their demand. Expect future conflict markets in the usual global hotspots. However, introducing an industry vested in conflict into the most conflict-prone places on Earth is vexing since it exacerbates war and misery. The reemergence of mercenaries is one of the most dangerous trends of our time, yet it is invisible to most observers. That is by design. The implications of a resurrected market for force and world affairs are substantial. Offering the means of war to anyone who can afford it will transform warfare and the future of war. If money can buy firepower, then large corporations and the super rich will become a new kind of superpower. This will rewrite the rules of global order, not seen since 1648. Who, how, and why people fight will change, and there will be wars without states, accelerating global chaos. Like the issue of terrorism in the 1990s, we need to boost our strategic IQ on private warfare or suffer a strategic surprise. End of quote. While I have some differences with McFadden here, I do generally agree with him, but I don't think that there's any stopping this trend from continuing, improving, enlarging, and becoming a bigger and greater player on the world stage. Look, the bottom line is markets are always more effective at delivering goods and services than any government could be. Remember, we had East Germany, some of arguably the most smart people on Earth. Not even they could make socialism or communism work. We've also seen that government supremacism, that umbrella rubric for socialism, communism, Mussolini-style state corporatism, fascism, and all of those isms that make collectivism the sine qua non raison d'etre for the way society is organized and structured. Also, by the way, that society that is organized collectively is done through the threat of force and violence or the use of force and violence, depending on the level of compliance. One will find oneself in most nations on Earth as a result of the conditions that they impose in forcing society to bend the knee, to be fined, kidnapped, caged, maimed, or killed, depending on their level of resistance. So the fact that these PMCs, these private military corporations, these mercenary organizations, and arguably one can say that there have been instantiations historically in which banditry and outlaw behavior lent itself as the first indicators or the first winks and nods towards which insurgencies, rebellions would develop. And this is the wolf and wharf. This is the fabric of civilizational change throughout human history is going to be these kind of rebellions, which for the most part have started privately for private reasons and then expanded. So I agree with McFate. Mercenaries and PMCs are here to stay. And how nation states deal with those will have to be in a way that doesn't amount to prohibition, but cooperation, co-opting, and working with them. Because there's no getting rid of the mercenary impulse in conflict. Thanks for listening. This is Bill Buepert. I would appreciate your comments, recommendations for future podcast episode subjects, maybe disagreements that you have with me, gentlemanly disagreements that are freighted with evidence and Socratic drilling and reasoning that would best what I have just prognosticated upon. If you wish to reach out to me, you can go to my Substack, which is in the show notes. You can reach out to me directly by email at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. And I do tilt at the Pentagon windmill 3 to 5 times a week as the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute. So I blog there, and you can find those things that I just mentioned. I wanted to thank all my listeners for your solicitude. Please leave a review, stars, or narrative if you wish. And please recommend me to friends, family, and colleagues. Again, thanks for your support. This is Bill out.